Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm Mike Seymour, and this week we have a really interesting discussion over the Animation Guild. But as I'm not from California and not an American even, I thought I'd actually do something slightly different this week and actually get Jeff, who did the interview, to join me on the line from Los Angeles so we can maybe discuss some of the context of this interview that was in fact actually recorded at the end of last year. Jeff, are you there?
Yes. Hello, Mike. How are you?
Good. So, look, as I said in the intro, we are very keen, obviously, at FX Guide to explore a bunch of issues. But for somebody that's not from North America, they may not even be familiar with what the Animation Guild is or anything about it. Could you just fill me in on who you're talking to this week?
Sure. We're going back to visit with Steve Hewlett from the Animation Guild. We interviewed him once before. We had started to do a labor series podcast. And Mike, you know, your opening comment, I would love to never have to do a podcast about labor issues. I wish we could just cover visual effects and in a broader, more, this is what's cool way, because that's what we love. But this all came to our attention. We had heard about the Animation Guild, and we were kind of curious why there isn't a visual effects guild. So we went and talked to Steve a while back. And then right before we actually recorded him, we heard about the Journey to the Center of the Earth situation, where those artists weren't getting paid up in Canada and had been fighting for a while to get their money. And well, that situation all has finally been resolved, although not at 100%, but at least they did get some money finally years later. But anyway, that's when we went to talk to Steve. And then recently we did the interview with Ed Albrick about the AICP Digital, and Scott Ross touched on a lot of these same issues. So I thought it'd be good to just kind of to talk about these things. And
well, I think another thing, Jeff, is one of the reasons we're talking about it is that somebody needs to talk about it. And I certainly feel like these issues are so prevalent to all concerned. But, of course, most of the popular press isn't going to pick up on it. It's kind of left to a small group of us to kind of raise that flag. Otherwise, the issue isn't discussed much in public, or at least in an online kind of press kind of sense.
Yeah, that's correct. And, these things, you say the word union, you say the word guild, and some people get a little squirrely and start getting nervous about stuff. And even before you talk about things like guilds or unions, I just want to say to people, if you're an artist, if you're a freelance person, if you're an employee, I don't care what you are, it behooves you to know the rules, the rights. What are the laws in your area?
Look, and I think one of the most astounding things is that while we're seeing the individual, as it were, suffer, I mean, if you look at the top grossing films of this year, there are films in those categories of mega blockbusters that are really opening because of visual effects. They're not opening because of the stars, they're not opening because of clever plot, they're not even opening because of, any kind of story premise. It's just literally visual effects is front and center, and it's making money. It's generating enormous box office receipts. And at the same time that this visual effects presence is being so strongly felt at the box office, which would normally in Hollywood or anywhere else equate to power, we're seeing the exact opposite happen at the artist level.
No, sure, absolutely. In fact, there was a Box Office Mojo has this little gizmo you can go to, and you can look up the box office by category for each Oscar through the years. And I was just poking around on it, and I was kind of amused by it. And I noticed that the average for Best Picture is in the $70 million range almost every year. And that's over 5 or 10 films. And yet, in visual effects, it's almost always, even with the stellar performance of Avatar skewing things, it's almost always in the $300 million range.
I mean, why? Yeah, I mean, so obviously the question comes, why are artists so poorly, being able to benefit, why are they benefiting so poorly from this enormous success? Why aren't they able to benefit more and enjoy some more of the success? Because quite frankly, if it was a director or an actor that was causing this kind of box office phenomenon, you'd expect them to be priced through the roof.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, we're going to have some blowback on a film like District 9, as great as it was. I think that, Jeff Oakham did a podcast, a brief podcast somewhere else, where he mentioned that, we're going to be hearing about that from the studios for years to come now, the budget of that film versus the budget of most visual effects films. So we do pay
a price. Yeah, I mean, I obviously, look, you could have used the same argument, and obviously some people did, when Blair Witch Project came along, and, Blair Witch Project made an enormous amount of money and was shot on a very domestic level camera, but I think that the argument at our level can certainly go beyond that. I think that it's pretty easy to point to the fact that You know, for every one of those examples, you can throw up that terrific quote from the producer: "If I don't put one visual effects company out of work on a picture, then I'm not doing my job properly."
Right. Exactly. So, I mean, the thing I wanted to point out to people before we get to the interview with Steve is that, find out your labor laws. You know, find out, for example, in California, find out the independent contractor rules. Find out how that affects you. Find out the overtime rules. Find out what the state of California specifies is supposed to be paid in overtime. I had an interview set up with a guy from the state of California who I have not been able to finish up with for a long, long time now. Who informed me that there's no such thing as a 10 or 12-hour day. The only thing that exists in the state of California is an 8-hour day. Time and a half after 8, double time after 12. That's the law. Now, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not telling you get on the front porch with your boombox with this podcast in front of your, you know, the front of your facility. I'm just saying you as an artist bear the responsibility of finding these things out. And you may not be able to do anything about it. I mean, you may be talking to somebody about a job and they may say, we pay flat. Now, you have a decision to make. In my opinion, and Ed Albrecht talked about this, this puts the business at some real competitive disadvantage things when somebody's not following the rules. But you also have the power to break that competitive disadvantage when they can't hire the people they want because they won't work for the terms that they're offering. So it's all about individual. Everybody has a responsibility. We can try to give you information. We can try. If anybody has any suggestions of people we can talk to on this subject, we'd love to hear about it. But
yeah, I think we're quite openly saying we don't have the solution. We simply want to make sure that the question has enough spotlight cast on it that it's well discussed.
Right. It's very much the shine a light on it approach. And know the laws. And then that also tells you when you are working for someone who's not following what you know to be right, what type of person you're dealing with. So, I mean, it works a lot of ways in your favor. You can then approach things from a different mindset. I've got a couple ideas for some more podcasts, but I'd love to hear any ideas anybody has for this. To Steve, I had more questions that I just didn't feel we answered, and time's passed a couple of years since we talked to him last time, and he's obviously an expert. I mean, he's got thousands of members in the animation side, including some visual effects artists already. In the guild, and I wanted to ask some questions. So
Jeff, if somebody wanted to send you some suggestions or wanted to send you something that maybe they didn't want public, how would they be best to go about talking to you?
They could email me at jeff@fxguide.com is fine.
That's an email that I'll only go to Jeff, and no one else but Jeff will see that. And if for any reason you want to talk about or suggest something, there's no risk of that going to anyone else, not even me. I don't see Jeff's emails. It's just to you.
No, and you can be very clear in your email to me about, the situation, about what it is. And we tend to focus on the United States, I do anyway, on these podcasts because that's where I am, like I said. But, I mean, these situations, I mean, there was an article, a post on VFX wages not too long ago about detailing some abuses in China. And I'm sure this is going on around the world. I mean, and we actually, Steve and I talk about some of that in the podcast about how other industries have seen repeats of some of the mistakes that we made in the United States in the 30s happening again and again, over as things have moved around the world. The industries have shifted. These problems aren't unique. You know, any problems that we're having with labor in the United States, it's all going to affect everybody. Everybody's going to have the same problems. It's just going to be a matter of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And that website, by the way, that Jeff just mentioned, if you are curious of checking it out, is actually www.vfxwages.com. So, Jeff, why don't we go to that interview now, and then I might catch up with you again after the interview's over.
All right, well, thanks for joining us again on this FX podcast. I'm really happy to come see your new building. Very nice space.
Yeah, we should look around after you're done. I can show you some of the glories of the building because it's quite nice, and it's great to be in Burbank, over from the wilds of North Hollywood, and here we are in Burbank.
Yeah, I was. I have a gallery. That's a great idea, and I love. I've obviously seen on your blog, the Animation Guild blog.blogspot.com, some of the work of your father, the Christmas work. It's great to see it in person in the gallery. Is that something people can stop by if they're in the area?
Yeah, they can stop by. We're open from 8:30 to 5, and stop by and look through the gallery. It's open during business hours and not during business hours, so that would be the time to see it.
It's been great, Joe, seeing the artwork on the blog, and your blog in general. I really have to thank you for that. It's been a great resource just to let people like myself see some of the stuff that you guys do and the thoughts, and I really appreciate that.
Well, it's a labor blog. I get complaints that, why do you have this labor stuff on this cartoon blog? And I say, well, did you look at the name?
Yeah.
The Animation Guild blog.
I will say, sitting in the lobby for a few minutes there and looking at the array of pamphlets as a visual effects artist and seeing, you know, healthcare information and 401k information, the stuff that normally would be provided by, you know, employers, and obviously as the visual effects world has moved much more toward a freelance world and a global world, I was amazed at the array of stuff. I mean, you actually have a lab here at SET about for people to come by and print, members to come by and use computers, for example?
We have a lab, and we're going to be upgrading that lab over the next few months because a lot of our equipment is ancient. Saying it nicely, and I think what we're going to be doing is upgrading the software and the hardware, and I think that'll happen early in the new year.
I'm sure it's been a lot of work getting over to the new building. That's always such a big endeavor.
Well, it's been a strenuous year. We've had a couple of negotiations. I was involved, not directly, but I was attending all of the negotiations for the IA basic agreement, and then we had our contract negotiations in the spring and summer, and then we had fall negotiations that I participated in for IM Digital and TSL, which is a Disney contract. Now, those contracts are held by the IATSC, not by Local 839, but we're heavily involved in seeing that the negotiations go well.
Just to recap, I guess, since we did a previous podcast, we went through a lot of this, but just kind of, if you could give us kind of an overview of who you represent in this guild.
We represent about 2,500 artists, writers, technicians, CG artists, traditional animators, board artists, and today, in 2009, more than ever before, everything's digital to a greater or lesser degree. Most of the studios now have Cintiqs for the board artist. There are a few board artists that are still boarding on paper, but very few compared to the overall majority.
This weekend, HBO ran a documentary called Shmata, Rags to Riches to Rags, and it was a really interesting, I know I asked you before we started if you'd seen it, it was just a really interesting glimpse of the garment industry in New York City, and talked about the, you know, basically in 1965, 95% of the clothing was manufactured in the United States, for the United States, and in 2009, it's 5%. And they just did a really good job of kind of explaining corporate America's influence and how we don't produce things anymore. And I just kept thinking you could take that timeline and apply it to so many different industries, just shift it around here and there. And obviously, we're seeing a great deal of that in visual effects. I mean, it's clear that the unions didn't cause this in New York. I mean, when you start comparing the cost of labor on a global scale, it doesn't matter. There's no comparison. You can't compete in those kind of numbers. How does the unions work with this? I mean, how does this apply to our industry?
Well, unions are funny because unions used to be free trade back in the 30s and 40s. And now today, we've got a situation where labor unions are pretty much taking the position of the Republican Party from 1865 until about 1965, which was protectionist. Theodore Roosevelt, Garfield, all the way through Harding, all the way through Eisenhower, all the way through Richard Nixon, the watchword was the protectionist tariff. In fact, George Herbert Walker Bush's father, Prescott, voted against loosening the tariffs in 1965. So there was a century where the Republican Party was strongly in favor of tariffs to keep other manufactured goods out, cheap manufactured goods in particular. And now, of course, the watchword is, oh, what we all need is free trade. I don't have a problem with free trade as long as people have jobs to go to. And I don't mind free trade as long as everybody can make a workable wage. But the problem is we've eviscerated the manufacturing part of the national economic base. And the Animation Guild has had this problem since the late 60s, early 70s. In fact, we had two lengthy strikes over this issue. One in 1979 where we won, and then one in 1982 where we lost.
Well, I think in general, what I was fascinated by this show was just talking about the history, because I think it's something that people need to understand. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the history of, I mean, why isn't there a union in visual effects, for example? I mean, why do you have any insight on that, or what history can you bring to us about unions and visual effects?
There's been a little union visual effects. For instance, the TSL contract, which is still held by Disney, was done for the Secret Lab and still has a title in its in the contract, TSL, the Secret Lab. The Secret Lab was an effects house at Disney. The problem with visual effects, the reason that it's traditionally been hard to organize, there's multiple reasons, but the ones that come to me observing it closely and talking to a lot of visual effects artists is in the early days when salaries were very high because there were very few people that could do the work, they were very libertarian. They pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. They didn't need no stinking union. And today, when that situation has changed quite a bit because there's quite a large talent pool and the salaries have declined, the market salaries have declined. What you've got now is you've got a situation where the studios that are doing it fight hard against unionization because the profit margins are razor thin. And in fact, I can't think of too many visual effects houses that stay in business over long stretches of time. They're like mushrooms, you know, they sprout up and they die off. And the people that were employees at the previous visual effects shop go out and start their own visual effects. And so you get this continual wave and newer wave and newer wave. And, of course, now there's visual effects being offshored because it's been this kind of race to the bottom. The problem with that is that studios lose quality control, and it isn't all that less expensive. You know, I'm sure you can compete when it's two guys in their garage against an infrastructure in India.
Race to the bottom is funny. It's a phrase that's come up quite a bit. It came up at the VES production summit. It came up in that documentary on HBO I was talking about. Seems to be the common phrase. But I guess my question is, visual effects and thinking about a union, for example, why isn't there like, I mean, we had a hard time finding, I mean, since we had talked to you previously, I wanted to get other people in other unions to talk to about this. And we had a hard time. I mean, people flat out just didn't want to talk to us about this, didn't want to go, you know, do a podcast with us about this subject.
About visual effects?
About visual effects and union.
I think there are some unions in the IA that are probably frightened of taking in a lot of visual effects artists because, like we talked about earlier, it would dilute their traditional base. And so they shrink from doing it. Essentially, the animation union is a visual effect. I mean, that's all that Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was. It was one long Technicolor 1937 visual effect because certainly there were no people in it. It was all hand-drawn visual effects. And in fact, the way they did animated cartoons was the way they did a lot of visual effects. I mean, if you go back to Forbidden Planet, Walt Disney Productions subcontracted that job from MGM. All the visual effects in Forbidden Planet, 1955 or 56, whenever it was done, was an animated visual effect superimposed over a live-action film. So now you've moved from the analog into the digital, and visual effects and animation are very close together and very simpatico because essentially they're all the same thing. There's very little difference between visual effects in video games, visual effects in movies, and visual effects in an animated cartoon. Even the hand-drawn animated cartoons of the 1990s had lots of digital effects in them. And so it's all melded together. There is no difference.
Now, you've mentioned on your blog several times talking about some of the previous organizational efforts like Sony. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yeah, the Sony thing. And that was quite a lively discussion in the comments section of our blog a week or two ago. What essentially happened was The IA and the Animation Guild went in jointly and organized the pre-production on animated features at Sony Pictures Animation, secured a contract, and at the same time, they secured an agreement from Sony, the IA did, that there would be a vote for unionization at Sony Pictures Imageworks. What happened was...
What year was this?
This was probably, 2001, 2002, the early 2000s, I think. Okay. It might have been 2003, somewhere in there. It all kind of blends together after a while. What year was what? Did I do that when? Because you tend to repeat yourself over and over and over, and so you forget when you did what. We organized Film Roman in... late 2004, and I think the Sony thing happened a couple of years before that. What specifically happened at Sony was Sony Pictures Imageworks employees were really divided into two factions. There were the permanent employees who really had a nice array of benefits. They had profit sharing. They had a good 401k with a match. They had a terrific corporate medical plan. And the permanent employees, which comprise probably about 25% to 30% of the staff, were hard against unionizing because then they would get the motion picture industry and pension and health plan benefits, and they would also get the union 401k plan. They felt that the health plans were pretty much similar. But they thought that they'd be losing profit sharing. They'd be losing the rich 401k plan that they had. So the permanent employees were hard against it. What the IA's calculation was, is, and this was explained to me by one of the West Coast reps for the international, was that, well, that might be true, but about 65% to 70% of the employees are production hires. And the production hires got very little. I mean, they got an HMO. They got none of the benefits of the permanent employees, by and large. And this was acknowledged in the discussion last week on the blog, that the permanent employees got a lot, and the temporary employees, i.e. the production employees, got very little. But, and here was the rub, and this is why the vote went against us. At the time, they were expanding, and the production hires saw themselves as shifting into the permanent employee status. And it's the old axiom of when a poor man always envisions himself as one day being rich, and so the poor man will more often than not side with the rich man because that's where he's going to. And sometimes that's true, and more often than not, it's not true. But what happened was the temporary production hires that the IA assumed would be voting in the majority sided with the permanent employees and voted the contract down. And it became pretty obvious that there was a fairly vigorous campaign going on among the permanent employees to get the vote turned down, and that in fact did the case. And in point of fact, and this has also been on the blog, you know, the IA's presentations left something to be desired. Kevin Cook, our president, and I, we were both sort of pushed to the side in this whole operation, and we were present. But for one meeting, we were told, you know, just if somebody gives you a question, you can answer it. But for the rest of it, let us do the talking. So we were basically sitting on the sidelines watching this whole thing unfold. And the meetings could have gone a lot better. But I don't think that would have made a whole lot of difference. I think the permanent employees had convinced the production hires that their long-term interests were in voting the contract down. And so in point of fact, it did. And we had our heads handed to us. I think we lost, it was either 88 to 12 or 92 to 8 or something like that. It was a pretty I think it was maybe in the 80s, somewhere in the 80s, but it was a rout in the vote. And it wasn't like we were stupid. We could see this coming. I knew days before that we were going to go down. And in the IA knew that they were going to go down. The head of the then head of the West Coast office said to me, "I have a bad feeling about this." And I said, "Yeah." And I had a meeting with a lot of Disney employees the day before the vote, and one of them came up to me and said, "You know, I have friends at ImageWorks, and you guys are going to lose badly." And I looked at him and said, "Yeah, I know." So it wasn't a surprise, but that was the reason it went down. I think it was some missteps by the AIATSC and us, and also a vigorous campaign internally to get it defeated, and the production hires siding with the permanent employees to defeat it.
Are there other efforts that you know of that have gone on with other companies in the business that you can think of?
More recently, one of the West Coast IA reps and I went out. We got a report, and I can't even remember the studio. It was a large studio. They were doing the kind of visual effects, you know, that turn live action into the sort of weird line drawings that they use in commercials and things
like
that.
Those insurance commercials, though.
Right, the insurance commercials, and there's been some others. They made a whole movie with Robert Downey, which came and went in about 5 minutes in that style. Anyway, there's a company out in Thousand Oaks that, or Agoura, that was employing a lot of folks that were converting the live action, and they were all making 10 and 12 bucks an hour. And we had a large, fairly enthusiastic meeting with them. And then the company got wind of the discontent and ran around and managed to shut it down. I mean, generally what happens is a company will work real hard to shut down any organizing drive by making threats. And the basic threat is, you guys go union and we'll shut the doors. Now, specifically, that's outlawed in federal legislation, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 as amended. But the reality is, it goes on all the time. When laws aren't enforced, they're hardly laws at all. And that's the case of the United States in 2009. There's a lot of abuses that go on. And, you know, employees aren't stupid. They know that the abuses go on, and they know that the abuses are not going to be answered by any kind of punishment for people violating the laws. So, in fact, just before you walked in, I was talking to a union member at one of the studios where they regularly falsify time cards, you know, put down 40 hours when they work 50 or 60 or 70. This goes on all of time, and the union is good at stopping it here and there, but we don't stop it all the time because there's just not enough hours in the day, and you can't stop people from cutting their own throats when it's triggered by fear of unemployment, of, you know, losing their job. And so this kind of stuff goes on all the time. Are there labor violations? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's a few standard answers I get when I talk to people about this. And keep in mind, we're not FX Guide, for example, is not endorsing or proposing anything. We're just trying to get information, because I think that that's the thing that's lacking the most. And I think that when the subject of union comes up, people get nervous, but they don't really have a clear understanding, you know? And that's why I've tried to talk to you about some of the benefits of what you bring to the artist, because I think things have shifted so rapidly in the last few years. In the visual effects world, so many companies now are operating with a very small full-time staff and a lot of permalancers and freelancers. And so I guess I'm just trying to – there's a bunch of – when I get into a conversation about union, people say things like, "It's too late." So I just want to throw out a few of these and see how you respond. Like, that's one of the first things people say.
I'm doing a blog post on that now. "Oh, it's too late. You've missed the boat." Well, you know how long I've been getting that? I've been getting that the whole time I've been here, and I've been here a lot of years. "It's too late. Missed the boat. Ship's pulled out.
Yep.
And no, it's not true. I mean, the problem is it's a very fluid industry that is constantly changing. Companies are constantly collapsing. Several years ago, we went up and assisted Canadian unions to organize. Disney had some animation studios, a big one in Toronto, and a slightly smaller one in Vancouver. And we went up and held meetings. So we couldn't go up there and do it because it's another country. But we went up there and assisted some Canadian unions, and the employees went, "Oh, well, yeah, but, you know, this is Disney, you know, and if we rock the boat, well, they'll close the studios and take all the jobs away." So there was a push. They failed to get enough cards. It's somewhat easier to organize in Canada because they have card count, or did then. And the animation employees ultimately didn't organize the studios. They stayed non-union. What do you know? A year and a half later, they closed. But how could this be? Because the employees all played the game. They didn't organize. They didn't unionize. They were all good little Indians, to use an overworked racist phrase. But they didn't. They didn't do anything to make the employer mad at them, and the employer closed the studios anyway. Why? Because it was in the studio, in the employer's economic self-interest. Specifically, it was, they decided, we'll keep the studio open on Australia, but we'll close the ones in Canada. And then we'll do some of the work in Japan, and some of the work in Korea, and some of the work here, and some of the work there. I mean, in point of fact, animation has been outsourced to all points of the globe since at least 1968-69. There was only a period, you know, in the 40s, 50s, and early to middle 60s where there was not outsourcing going on. I mean, there was some outsourcing. There's always a little. I mean, Rocky and Bullwinkle was done in, done in Mexico. But for the most part, outsourcing in the animation industry has been going on in a kind of full-throated way since 1970-71. And so it's something that we've had to deal with all the time. But what I point out to people, in 1970, we had about 1,500 active dues-paying members. Today, 2009, we have 2,540 active dues-paying members. So how can that be? Because all the work's gone away and has been outsourced, and we've missed the boat. Well, it's because the pie continually changes and expands, and work comes and it goes, and studios do things which they find in their economic self-interest. 2 years later, they find something else to be more in their economic self-interest. They'll outsource when it suits them, and they'll insource when it doesn't suit them. They're not going to do it to keep employees happy. They'll do it because it's, you know, suits their business model, it suits their schedule, it suits their budget. In the middle 90s, the thing that was funny is everybody was slavishly following the Disney hand-drawn animation model. Everything was done in-house, with some small exceptions, but everything was done pretty much in-house. And they didn't succeed doing it that way, so they abandoned the model. But there was about a 4 or 5 year period, probably from about 1993-94 until the late 90s, where everybody did everything in hand-drawn animated features, soup to nuts, from storyboards and writing through story development, through rough animation, finished animation, color, cleanup. Everything was done in-house in Southern California. That has now changed. Disney is now outsourcing stuff on The Princess and the Frog. They will certainly outsource on their Winnie the Pooh feature, which will be upcoming. I mean, the budget on the Winnie the Pooh feature, I'm told by people who work at Disney, is $35 million. And Princess and the Frog was $105 million. In point of fact, you know, budgets are elastic, and you can get pretty good quality at a whole lot of different budget points. So it changes.
I understand you have members that are in the visual effects area as well. Can you talk about that already? You already have members that are in visual effects.
Well, yeah. I mean, we represent a lot of the crew at IM Digital. And, I mean, I consider Christmas Carol as one large visual effect.
Yeah.
We represent that crew. We've represented, there have been visual effects crews at Warner Brothers when they were in the big May Company building and the Sherman Oaks Galleria. They had a sizable visual effects crew. We represented that. We represented the Secret Lab crew at Disney's. They did any number of visual effects there. Up north, for many years, it's not right now, but I'd say there was about a 15 or 20 year run where the ILM visual effects crew was largely unionized. No longer the case, but up until a couple of years ago it was. So there have been visual effects crew that have been unionized, and I don't remember in all the years that ILM was prospering and their staff was union that, oh, gee, it drove them out of business. Unionization does not drive companies out of business. Bad management drives companies out of business. You know, unions basically are there at the margins, improving life for employees at the margins. But if a studio is badly run, it's going to go down, union or non-union. And that's just the way it is. And it's the way it's always been. The union issue does not, for the most part, I'm sure you can find exceptions, but for the most part, it doesn't drive companies out of business. I think that's the big hue and cry about, well, GM was driven out of business by unionization. No, GM was driven out of business by bad management. Ford, also unionized, gone merrily along, wasn't part of the federal bailout, and it's unionized. So, no, unionization is not the central issue. The central issue is good management, bad management, good business model, bad business model.
They made a great point in that documentary about the Triangle Shirt Factory fire in New York.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, it changed the labor framework in this country after that because of the reaction to that. And then they made the point that there's been a fire like in 2000 in, I can't remember where it was, Bangalore or something like that, which was basically the same exact scenario. People locked in, garment workers, same thing. And I think that's the question I would ask is there's no question we have a global economy. There's no question people are going to shift work all around the country. Most of the major studios now have divisions, and even small companies are starting to put other places in other countries, outposts, to take advantage of tax incentives or to take advantage of lower labor costs.
Oh, yeah. Companies are there for the stockholders and to maximize profits. That's why they exist. That's why, in my opinion, it's absurd to have for-profit, health insurance companies administering health care. It's absurd because, after you get done with their 30% markup, it's no wonder that, health care that we've got in this country is close to double what it is anywhere else because we're the only people that say, oh, yeah, let's let somebody come in and rake a whole lot of money off the top. And it's far worse today than it was in my youth. In my youth, the profit margins are, 5, 6, 7%. Now, if you're not raking in an extra 30%, you're not doing your job. And as CEO, you're fired. So it's totally absurd. And that's why I find the whole healthcare debate totally absurd. We should just simply have single payer, and the hue and cry is it'll bankrupt the country. No, it won't. You raise taxes. We used to have a 70% marginal tax rate all the time I was growing up. Dwight Eisenhower had a 70-80% marginal tax rate at the top, and I don't remember the company. There's a Freudian slip. I don't remember the country collapsing under Dwight David Eisenhower. It just didn't happen. It didn't happen in the 60s. It didn't happen in the 70s, where we get into these long, drawn-out wars that drain the treasury. That becomes a problem. But, if we do enough overseas adventures, we'll become Great Britain and Spain. So that's where that'll go. That's why I just think you've got to find some mechanism, either through some sort of tariff system, or if you're going to go the total free trade route, then you've got to nurture education, you've got to nurture training facilities, you've got to go high-end on your manufacturing, and you've got to have a tax system where the people at the bottom, you know, I think Reagan was completely right for, you know, with the earned income tax credit, where people that were making not very much money basically got a government subsidy. And that was expanded by Ronald Reagan. I mean, he had the right idea in that regard because, you know, you've got to have some mechanism where people have earning power and can buy houses and become part of the society and contribute to it and consume, because consumption is 70% of the economy. And if you don't have people that have any money, they're not consuming. And that becomes a problem. It destabilizes the whole economic system. I mean, that's my feeling anyway.
Sure. Yeah, as I was coming over here, I got a breaking news alert on my phone that said that the Dow was at a new record and recession is ending. And I'm like, yeah, because everybody's not working. You know, you cut your employee base, you make your profits to make your profit margins, of course. And it was an article about the fact that we really use metrics to measure these things that don't take into account these new realities.
Well, we have, you know, we have an 18%, you know, U6, which is the underemployed, the no longer looking for work, you know, and their unemployment benefits have run out. I mean, the percentage is like 17-18%. I mean, this is close to the Great Depression level. You know, the underemployed and the discouraged from looking for work, I mean, it's a horrendous number. And it's been a horrendous number. And the official, you know, the official rate is 10.2. Well, we haven't seen that since 1983. And prior to that, 1941, during the Disney strike, 1941, we had 10% unemployment. That was coming out of the, you know, the 1938 re-depression. We came back up out of it. 34, 35, 36, and then Franklin Roosevelt was talked into cutting back spending, and he cut back spending and tried to balance the budget, and we went right back into recession. So, you know, yeah, it never changes, and you're always going to have people overreaching, and then you're going to have their public relations people trying to explain and justify why it's really good that, you know, 0.5% of the population has 90% of the wealth. And if you buy it, great. I don't, but many do.
So I surveyed a bunch of people just casually over the past few weeks as I was preparing to do this. And one of the questions people asked me to ask was, it would seem like the visual effects industry in crisis, that there would be informational meetings or something to people to understand unions better, or, you know, there would be easy to understand websites explaining how this, what unions do for people and how the process works. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, we've talked at various times, not real recently, about holding informational meetings. And informational meetings generally don't work real well. I mean, I'll give you an example. We have 2,500 members. Now, a lot of them, a goodly number of them are out of the county, but we have quite a few here. You know, our union meetings, we have six a year. We get from a low of 30 people to a high of 80 or 90 people that show up. We advertise them. I put them on the blog. I do all this stuff. People don't show up. And the problem with holding an informational meeting is, unless there is a huge issue, a huge immediate explosive issue, people are not going to show up. And so, I mean, I went to a, and this is years ago, UCLA, big informational meeting. All the unions, so the SAG was there, WGA was there, the IA was there. There's like 10 union reps, and I was one of them representing animation. And there was more of us than there were people in the audience. There were more people up at the table. And, you know, and I know that the WGA has held meetings where, for candidates forum. And one of the staffers, and this goes back several years, one of the staffers said, you know, there were more people up at the table on the stage than there were in the audience. And the reality is that people have a lot of options what to do with their time. And most people go, yeah, well, go to a union informational meeting. I'm not going to go. So in point of fact, you can gin up attendance, not real high, but you can gin it up depending on the topic, depending on the issue. I would be happy to hold informational meetings about organizing the visual effects industry if visual effects artists called me and said, hey, we want you to set this up. Be happy to do it. We've got a big room upstairs, new building. We can do it. Nobody does. And generally, it takes so much energy to set it up and tub-thump yourself that if there's not some immediate symbiotic reason, then you just don't do it. I do other things with my time. But I've attended a lot of different forums over the years, and sometimes they're well attended and a lot of times they're not. It's just, I mean, my feeling about the visual effects business is in the 90s, it was very libertarian. Everybody was doing well because there was only a limited number of people that knew how to do the work. I can give you a good example. Dinosaur, the Disney visual effects extravaganza from the late 90s, it took them a year and a half to staff, to find the people that they needed, because they were looking for people who had great expertise and production experience. And they weren't out there in 96, 97 when they were recruiting. They just had a hell of a time. Now it's not so hard because the industry, the talent pool's a lot larger. But then it was. But that's still a lot of the mindset that I think is in the workforce of visual effects. Libertarian, what do I need a union for? I make my own deals. I don't need it. Blah, 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 blah. Now the difference is, and I've seen this over the time I've done this, is the workforce gets older and they don't want to sleep under their computer at night. And they don't want to have their social life doesn't revolve around the workplace because they're not 22 and 23 and 24 anymore. Now they've gone out and they've met a significant other and they're setting up housekeeping and they're raising kids. And suddenly working 100 hours a week in the studio doesn't seem all that great anymore. They don't have a life. So it's changed. But, you know, you look at Electronic Arts, you know, down at Playa Vista. Their workforce is very young. When the people start to get old and complain, boop, they're gone. That's just the way it's worked.
You know, I came up with full-time jobs, with health insurance, with 401ks. And, you know, when you're young, those are things you don't really care about. You don't think about it. It's too far in the distance. You don't think about it. From my standpoint, looking back and knowing the importance of these things.
But see, your problem is you're older now looking back. I can give you a specific example of myself. I started at Disney. I mean, I lucked. You know, I've got a good union health plan, good union pension benefits, mostly by luck, because I started at Disney's in 1976. I was a story trainee. I started at the princely sum of $135 a week. And I was a trainee, and I jumped through all the hoops, and I was there for 10 years, and then I worked other studios, and then I came into this job, ran for this job, and I've been doing this a goodly number of years. But what happened to me when I was walking down the hallway of the old animation building is this older animator was shuffling along, and he looks at me, and he says, Steve, don't forget about your pension and health benefits. And I said, oh, yeah, okay, Terry, that's great. Yeah, fine, cool. And he walked on, and I thought, what is that old fool talking about? I mean, I was 27 years old. It was like, who cares? I was a couple of years out of the Navy. Who cares? You know, retirement? Pension? What's, you know, it was an abstraction. It was so far out in the future, as far as I was concerned, that I paid absolutely no attention. And that's the problem for everybody that comes into the visual effects industry or whatever industry in their 20s. They're totally oriented on the now. And they're totally oriented on climbing up the ladder. And somebody coming along to them talking about pension benefits, it's such an abstraction that they could care less. They just don't care because they're 25 years old. It was the same with me. I'm sure it was the same with you.
Yep.
And by the time you start, I mean, and here's the problem. By the time you wake up, I've had people come into my office at the other building, not this one, and say, I've been in the industry 35 years, and I worked almost all of it non-union. And I don't have anything. I'm 63 years old. I have no pension. I have Social Security. I'm not getting the work that I used to get because I'm 63 years old. What can you do to help me? And I look at them and say, nothing. You made your choices. You did what you did. And here you are. And this is the thing that I would communicate to anybody starting in the industry in their 20s. You want to work non-union shops? Fine. But you'd better be real disciplined about saving. And you'd better start putting money away into Roth IRAs and into 401ks and pay close attention. Pay close attention. 85-90% of the population that's in their 20s does very little thinking about it. I mean, I get all the time, you know, about money matters. They say, I'm an artist. I don't care about that. Well, they should care. I mean, they should care because it's their future and it's their well-being at stake. And I spend a lot of time on the blog. I haven't recently. I'm going to put another one up. But I pound the idea that put money into a 401k. You know, work union if you can. But save. You know, put away 10-15% of your weekly paycheck. Well, I can't do that. Well, everybody can do that. You know, if you're making 10 or 15% less, you find a way to make do. And that's just the reality. But most people don't. And by the time people wake up and start thinking about it, because they're like 40, 45, you know, about three quarters of the horses are out of the barn by that point. And that's the problem. By the time it becomes very important to people, it's almost too late. And that's why I tell people, you got to think about these things early on. And you either think about it by unionizing and getting into a union pension plan, or you don't have to go that route. You can also do your own individual pension savings plan and do pretty well. But most people don't have the discipline to do it. And most people will immediately, when they get unemployed, they dip into the 401k stash so that they can live. And I don't blame them. But the problem is you've got to have, you know, plan B, plan C, you've got to have escape hatches, you've got to know what you're doing and where you're going and how you're going to do it. And if you don't, you're going to find yourself in deep, deep trouble.
Well, thanks so much to Steve Hewlett, and thank you, Jeff, for doing that interview, and in fact, for doing all of these things. We tend to end up here at FX Guide sort of focusing on certain areas that are more one person's than another, which is a good way for us to not overlap, but also to cover a wide range of issues. And as Jeff said before that interview, if you'd like to suggest things for this or other areas that you'd like to see us discuss, go right ahead. But Jeff, you'll be doing more in this area, will you?
Yeah, I hope so. I've got a couple ideas lined up. I've got a couple people that I probably shouldn't mention yet, but who will definitely have some strong feelings about this. And like I said, Jeff at fxguide.com, J-E-F-F at fxguide.com is the way to reach me directly if you have some information or suggestions for people I can talk to. And I also want to repeat again, animationguildblog.blogspot.com is Steve's blog, and it's a labor blog, so don't be surprised. It's going to be a lot of talk about animation returns and movies, and you know, but I find it fascinating. He crosses into, it's all the same issues we deal with.
So. Well, again, that's been good talking to you, Jeff. I really appreciate it. And we might do this again. We might have a pre-chat before another interview.
We used to do it a lot. Yeah, the schedules got a little hard to coordinate, and the podcast became a little bit more self-contained oftentimes. So, but I just thought in this case it was a good idea to put a little context into this and to ask people for their input as we move forward in this. You know, like I said, I don't have an agenda here. I just want information. Like we always say about FX Guide, it's what, you know, we're interested in, and these are kind of questions that I have and that I hear people asking all the time. So,
oh, I have an agenda. I want people to work on good projects and get paid properly for them. I mean, you know, let's not beat around the bush here. But yeah, I totally agree with you. Thanks so much for listening, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.